welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a podcast where we explore the bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this episode, we continue our discussion with Steve Beyer, who is author of Singing to the Plants. Steve has a large sum of information on shamanistic traditions in South America, as well as their use of ayahuasca in their healing practices and in altered states of consciousness. As always, if you enjoy this podcast, we ask that you visit our website at taleaters.com/CE podcast, where you can donate and support our podcast through our Patreon page. Well, without further ado, let's get to the interview.
Dr. Ann, another question for you. My question is about the spirits and if they're particularly good or bad, and or if it's just based on how you use them, things like that. For instance, you know, I guess it's Brujo. They use spirits to attack people, and then healers use spirits to heal people. Do they use the same spirits? Are they different? Are they
evil? Yes, they call on the same spirits. They call on the same plant spirits. And there are certain plants that are very fierce and dangerous, and there are some plants that are very warm and nurturant. But it's the fierce and dangerous plants that are, in fact, the best protection against sorcery. Also, there's a tradition that the brujo plants, the sorcery plants, tend to be dark purple in color, and the plants that are used for healing are generally lighter and green in color. But the plants that can be used for harming are precisely the plants that can be used for protection against sorcery. One of the features of shamanism, I think generally, and I think particularly clearly in the upper Amazon, is that there is no bright line between a person who harms and a person who heals. Shamans are ambiguous. Shamans are socially marginal because they are both valuable and dangerous. The methods, the techniques that are used to harm are precisely the techniques and spirits that are used to protect against harm and to heal from harm. And I think this fits in to a kind of tragic view of life in the upper Amazon, where life and death and healing and harming, shamanism and sorcery, and predator and prey are all mixed together without bright lines between them. Predator-prey relationships, I think, are a good model for understanding this kind of tragic cosmo vision of the upper Amazon, because everything goes in great cycles of predator and prey, like the jungle is life feeding on life. And there are no bright lines between what helps and what harms. So, yes, there are spirits that tend to be fierce and dangerous plant spirit. The catawa tree, for example, is a fierce and dangerous tree. Other spirits are warm and nurturant, but they all can be used for healing and harming.
Great. I guess to go off of that, we read in your book about different types of ayahuasca, and we were really interested in the one that was called Rattle because I've never really heard of it before until I read your book. And you know, how does the different types of ayahuasca affect people differently, in the sense that there are different types of spirits, maybe, or is there something else going on? And can you tell us more about the Rattle ayahuasca?
I have not heard that the different kinds of ayahuasca have different spirits. They all have the spirit of ayahuasca. That's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of that. And I don't think there is complete consistency in the way people identify different kinds of ayahuasca. For example, in Colombia, most of the most potent ayahuasca are cultivars. They are grown in people's, in the shaman's own gardens. In Peru, the most powerful ayahuasca is generally considered to be a wild vine that grows deep in the jungle, and shamans will go searching for an old grandfather vine that has grown to great size over a long period of time. It's interesting that shamans from different indigenous groups in the upper Amazon will, with some consistency, identify different types of ayahuasca consistently. But the ways in which they classify different ayahuasca vines is very complex. It has to do with how old the vine is, with the texture of the bark, with its trading history or its cultivation history, or whether it has been used by great shamans in the past. So I don't think there's a great deal of order to it, although there is sometimes very surprising consistency in identifying these different types of ayahuasca. I have never had rattle ayahuasca. It is said to be the most powerful kind. If anybody out there listening to this has ever had anything that has been identified as rattle ayahuasca, I would be very interested in hearing about it. But it's called rattle ayahuasca because it rattles you, shakes your bones.
Interesting.
In speaking about kind of varieties and colors of things, I noticed that in Peter Gorman's book, Ayahuasca in My Blood, he describes red magic as kind of this, I don't know, it almost seemed healing, so to speak. But I noticed in your book that I got the impression that red and black were closer associated to sorcery. Is that correct? Or
yes.
Okay.
That's what I was told. Now, Peter wrote a wonderful book, and I recommend it to everybody. He is an outstanding writer. He's had great adventures, and it's altogether a wonderful book. But there are different traditions. I reported what I was told, that black magic is bad and red magic is absolutely the worst.
Okay. Red is the worst. All right.
That's what I was told.
Well, hey, that works for me. Another thing I really wanted to speak with you about is that I found it really interesting in your book, and I've heard this other places as well with other indigenous traditions, that the animals themselves see themselves as people. Could you speak a little bit more on this?
Yes, this is very clearly the case in the upper Amazon. It has been called perspectivism, and the idea is that animals see themselves as people, and as a matter of fact, their animal appearance is kind of a costume that they can put on and take off, so that tapirs, for example, see themselves as humans. They see the humans who hunt them as jaguars. They see the places where they wallow in the mud as being villages. And jaguars see themselves as people, and they see people as being like tapirs. And this is a good example of the what we were talking about just a minute ago. This idea that there are cycles of predation and prey, and prey and predator are very closely aligned, that there's no bright line between predator and prey, that life goes in these cycles of life and death and healing and harming and predator and prey. And it's interesting that animals can take off their animal appearance and be seen as humans, but humans never take off their human appearance and appear as animals. So that, in fact, the reason that a jaguar is ferocious is not because it's a jaguar, but because it's a person. And I think, again, this shows this tragic cosmovision of the upper Amazon, where you do not draw the kinds of lines between humans and animals, animals and plants, predator and prey, that I think are part of the European tradition.
Can you tell us a little about your experiences with Brugmansia?
With Toei?
Yes, yep.
I have never drunk Toei.
Okay, okay.
And to drink Toei is something that I just never had the right opportunity to do. And to anybody who was interested in doing it, I would urge them to do it only under the right circumstances. It's very, very powerful. I just never had the occurrence of the right time, the right shaman, the right circumstances. So I can't talk about that out of my own personal experience.
Doctor, we were wondering about the telepathy that people experience when they're experiencing a ayahuasca session in a group setting. I've heard a couple reports of it in a number of books, so I was just wondering what you have experienced with that, or if you know of experiences like that.
I have never experienced telepathy in a group setting. I have never heard of anyone experiencing telepathy in a group setting, but there have been reports of that. I have a whole section in my book about the reports of telepathy. And we have to be very careful how we use terminology, I think. There is no question that mestizo and indigenous people in the upper Amazon believe that ayahuasca gives you information about things that are happening far away. And as a matter of fact, one of the many uses of ayahuasca is to discover precisely that kind of information. Someone whose brother has gone far away and has not been sending messages may go to an ayahuasca session and drink ayahuasca for the express purpose of finding out how his brother is doing in this foreign country. Is he sick? Is he well? People will drink ayahuasca to find out things like the location of lost objects. They will drink ayahuasca in order to find out who is sleeping with their wife or who has cast a curse that is causing his business to fail or who has sent the darts that have made him sick that need to be sucked out by the shaman. So a lot of what ayahuasca is for is to find out factual information. And in that sense, the indigenous and mestizo traditions are consistent with notions of telepathy. If your word telepathy includes getting information from afar like that. There is also a tradition among indigenous and mestizo people in the upper Amazon that a shaman, through the use of the right songs, is able to control the visions of people who are drinking ayahuasca with that shaman. So that if visions begin to become terrifying, the shaman can modulate those experiences. If the person is drinking to find out a particular piece of information, like the lover of an unfaithful spouse, the shaman can sing the songs that can lead that person to have the right vision of who the betrayer is. So to that extent, to the extent that the shaman has access to the visions of someone who is drinking with the shaman, you can call that telepathy. My plant teacher, Doña Maria, when I would ask her questions about the plants, and I would bother her with all my questions, she would say, "I will show you." And what that meant was that the answer to my question would be given to me the next time I drank ayahuasca. If by telepathy you mean things like that, that is certainly consistent with the tradition. And there have been reports from Westerners who have sat and drunk ayahuasca with indigenous or mestizo people, where they were told by people who were drinking or by the shaman of events that were purportedly happening far away that involved that particular Westerner, that gringo. And these make terrific stories, and those things are consistent with indigenous and mestizo beliefs about ayahuasca. There is a tradition in Western writing that I have not been able to find among indigenous mestizo people, which may be what you're referring to by telepathy, which is that people sitting together share visions, or that people can learn indigenous languages through telepathy at ayahuasca sessions. And I have seen those claims made by gringos, by Westerners. The Wizard of the Upper Amazon.
Oh, I've seen it. I haven't read it. Okay.
Claims that, and he was a well-known and very highly regarded mestizo curandero who claimed, at least as his story was written down, that he had been kidnapped by indigenous people in the Upper Amazon. He had been taught their language in group telepathy sessions, and that he had been chosen to be their leader, and he finally escaped and came back and brought their healing secrets back to his clients. And this story has mythic resonances. I mean, there is a classic sort of myth about the person who is captured by the wild beings of the jungle and is taught their secrets and carries their redemptive secrets with him out of the wilderness and comes back and teaches them. Even a children's story like Where the Wild Things Are kind of conforms to that myth. And certainly Cordova del Rios' story conforms to that myth and has started this idea that people share visions and are taught languages and so on in group telepathy sessions. Now, I wish that was true. I wouldn't mind being able to learn Quechua in a few nights.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't mind if we had a way to get a bunch of people to sit around in a circle and I could drink ayahuasca with them and learn how to play the piano.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But I have not experienced anything like that. And as opposed to these other things I was talking about, I have not come across those as being part of an indigenous or mestizo traditions in the Amazon. Now, that doesn't mean they're not there, because my ignorance is tremendous. And it may very well be there are lots and lots of things out there. As a matter of fact, I think without doubt that there are lots and lots of things out there that I don't know anything about. But I haven't run across them. So I guess the short answer to your question is it depends on what you mean by telepathy.
I think that you answered the question pretty well, so thanks very much.
What can you say about the use of Ikaros without plant medicine?
That's a very interesting question. And in the book, I talk about the fact that mestizo shamanism is different from a lot of other traditions in the Upper Amazon because the shaman combines the functions of sucking shaman and plant healer. And in many other traditions, these two skill sets are kept very separate. And mestizo shamanism is different. In the traditions where herbalism and shamanism are kept separate, the shaman does not use actual physical plants. He uses the songs of the plants. And remember, these songs, these Ikaros, are not just songs of the plants. You have Ikaros for everything. You have Ikaros to summon the spirits of dead shamans. You have Ikaros to protect against snake bite. You have Ikaros to protect against thunder. You have Ikaros that are used to summon chuja chucky out of the jungle. You have Ikaros to call back people who have been kidnapped by the spirits who live under the water. You have songs for everything. And they are not just the songs of the plants, although part of the repertoire will be to call particular plants for healing. And in those traditions where herbalists and shamans are kept separate, the shamans will summon these healing spirits without actually using physical plants. and will leave to herbalists the use of plant medicines. In fact, in some of these cultures, pretty much everybody knows how to use medicinal plants. It's not a specialized knowledge set at all. Interestingly, I have run across from time to time the idea among mestizo shamans that there are certain plants that you don't need to use physically. All you need to do is to sing their icaros, and these have varied from one person to another. But I think you have several different traditions in the upper Amazon about the use of actual physical plants as opposed to using just the kinds of healing songs you would use.
A question for you, Steve, about the dangers of using ayahuasca without having, say, a trained shaman there with you to guide you through, not so much in the physical, but in the spiritual sense.
There have been a lot of debates online about this, and I have pretty much taken the position that I was taught, which is that the purpose of having a shaman there is really twofold. One of them is to protect the people who are drinking ayahuasca, because there are lots of things that can go wrong, all the way from resentful sorcerers attempting to influence the experiences of people who are drinking ayahuasca, or to harm them in ways that will continue after the ayahuasca session, to people who are having visions that are more than they can handle, and those visions need to be controlled, modulated, modified by the songs of the shaman. And it seems, it's interesting that both of those things, protection and guidance, are done through singing. Remember that for most of the people who go to an ayahuasca shaman, a mestizo ayahuasca shaman, and drink ayahuasca, the goal is the healing of the sickness. And that sickness may be defined in many ways as different from the kinds of things that gringos often consider sickness, like bad luck is considered a sickness that needs to be cured. But they're going there to have healing of some kind of disease. And their idea of what causes a disease and their idea of what resolution of suffering is very different from the ideas that gringos bring in with them. And what we are seeing is among the few shamans who have regular contact with gringos who are coming in, an interchange, an eclecticism, a syncretism between traditional upper Amazonian ideas and the ideas that these gringos are bringing in with them. It seems to me, and this is not to put anybody down, but it seems to me that there is a certain amount of arrogance involved in saying that I am simply going to ignore the teachings of this tradition with regard to the need for the protection of an experienced shaman to help you have the right kinds of visions and to protect you from those who would harm you, that you can just do without those, that protection, that you can just ignore the teachings of this tradition and just do it by yourself. And I am sure that there are people out there who do it and have experiences that are satisfactory to them. I know that there are economic barriers in the way of people going down to Peru and sitting with a shaman. I know that there are real problems finding the right kind of shaman, finding the shaman who is going to be the right one for you. I know there are all these problems. But you can ask whether it's supposed to be easy. You can ask whether the problems are things that need to be overcome rather than things to be ignored. And I think that if people say, oh, I can just drink it by myself, or I can get together with a bunch of my friends and we can sit around and drink this and nothing bad is going to happen, they may be right. Maybe nothing bad is going to happen. But I think, first of all, there is a lot of ego involved in saying that. I know better than the shamans of the upper Amazon how to drink ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And I think that if the shamans say that you need the protection of an experienced person to get you through this experience without harm, then I think we need to take that very seriously. And maybe these difficulties are there because part of the path is to overcome these difficulties, not to say that you don't need to overcome them. But that's just me. And I am sure that there are lots of people out there who drink by themselves or in a group of friends. And it's certainly not up to me to say how ayahuasca will treat anybody. That's up to ayahuasca. It's not up to me. And it would be arrogant of me to say, oh, I know better than than ayahuasca what should happen to people. But those are just my thoughts on that, for whatever they're worth.
That's great. Thank you.
How do you feel about La Dieta in terms of physiological benefits in general? I'm just thinking about, you know, how great I would feel if I really did abstain from sugar and salt.
It's not great. It's awful. A French anthropologist described the diet as dauntingly dull. And it's true if you're without salt or sugar. And remember, it's not just salt and sugar.
That's
it's
true,
sex.
True.
Going without sex, and you start to obsess about salt and sugar and sex. So it's not easy. I have helped people do vision fasts, and when I have done a vision fast myself, this is more radical than the diet where you do get to eat fish and plantains and things like that, so you're not hungry. But I think there are some similar things. The people who fast sometimes don't feel hungry. I'll tell you my experience, for whatever they're worth. The first day, you feel great, and you look at how well I'm handling this. And then by about the third night, I am really, really dreaming about pizza. And the jungle diet, I think, is the same. I think there are two things going on. I think one is that if you are going to establish a close relationship with the plants need to see that you are willing to suffer on their behalf. I was told over and over again that the plants are muy celosa. They are very jealous, and that there is almost a sexual, significant sexual component to your relationship with the plant spirits. They want you to be faithful. They do not want you having sex with other people. They want you to be devoted. They want you to win their love. And you win their love by devoting yourself to them, by sitting alone in the jungle. Remember, an important part of this is sitting alone in the jungle with not much to do. And you sit there and you start to develop through dreams, through visions, through subtle intentions in your heart, through snatches of melody and song. You begin to develop this relationship with the plant. A relationship of love, of awe, of dependency, of mutuality, of generosity, which is in some ways a model for the ways human beings ought to be relating to each other. And you are doing this in solitude, and you are doing this away from the kinds of social supports that you normally have. I think that one of the reasons why the great shamans are considered to be mitilleros, to be great hunters and fishers, is because they spend so much time alone in the jungle, and they get to listen, and they look, and they observe the animals, they observe the plants. And that brings up the second point, which is this. I think that one of the things that makes the diet work is the fact that it is so bland. There's no salt, there's no sugar. for many teachers, it includes no spices, no chili peppers. It includes no pork, no animal fat, no oil. It is a really bland diet, which I think may have an effect on your senses.
Heightened senses, or?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's it. I think that once you stop stimulating yourself with food, once you start eating this very bland, very simple diet, you become much more aware of what's going on around you. And that fits in with what I was saying earlier, that the great shamans have been great hunters and fishers. They are called, you know, men of the jungle, men who know the jungle, because they spend so much time just with heightened senses, sitting and observing, listening to the symphony of the jungle.
Stephen Beyer, your book is absolutely amazing, and I truly do believe that that in the future, I mean, anybody who is interested in ayahuasca should absolutely pick up Singing to the Plants.
Well, if you want more information, and also a place to order the book, is the website www.singingtotheplants.com. If you want to buy it, you can go to amazon.com. and look it up there. The paperback is available. There was originally a hardcover edition, which has pretty much sold out. And I have seen on Amazon that it is selling for absolutely ridiculous prices. Don't look at the hardcover, because that's sold out and there are only used copies left. But the paperback is available for either $20 or $30, because sometimes they have been offering a 30% discount and selling it for $20, although I see it's now listed at $30. Either way, it's a bargain. It's a beautiful book. They did a terrific job on this book. I am just so happy with the way the University of New Mexico Press put this book out. The cover is beautiful. The typesetting, the typography, the photographs, everything is really classy. They even have it on really good paper. So I am very happy with the job that the University of New Mexico Press did with this book. And I think it's beautifully put together. It'll last a long time. And you can get it at Amazon.com. There, maybe I've sold a couple of copies.
We sure hope so. Yeah, it's a great book, and I enjoyed it too very much. So
I am hoping that one of the effects this book will have, and may already have had, is to get more and more people telling their stories, sharing information, and if there is something in the book that is not consistent with their experience, I hope they will tell me that. But one of the best things that I can hear about the book is somebody who gets in touch with me and says, you know, I read your book, and that's exactly right. That's what my experience was like. We've been talking a lot about gringos going down to the Amazon. I think that a lot of people who go down to drink ayahuasca are unprepared and find themselves alienated from the culture whose medicine they are taking. And for some, perhaps even many people who go down to the Amazon, there is a kind of egoism that I am going down to find my healing. I am going down to heal my wounds. I am going down there for my transformative experience, for my transcendent experience, for my epiphany. And have no interest in the struggles and the culture of the people whose healing they are seeking. And I am hoping that the Singing to the Plants will give them some idea of what this culture is like. Not only, you know, in terms of its spirituality, but also just in terms of its everyday life. People go down to the Amazon and they sit in a in a retreat lodge, and people put food in front of them, and there is fruit and fish and meat and drinks, and they have no idea the kind of sophisticated forest management that produces this food. They sit in a retreat house and have no idea how that house has been put together out of the materials that are available in the jungle. And I hope that some of the discussion in the book will give people an appreciation for just the everyday things they encounter there and may otherwise take for granted.
I was reading your blog recently, and I saw that you were reviewing like a documentary about a camp that did ayahuasca sessions and stuff like that with it was a guy from California that was the, like, I forget the name of it, but you just said that pretty much it had, like, you know, it was a good job based on how they filmed it, you know, the film was good. But I was wondering, like, your opinion of, do you know what I'm kind of talking about, or
the film? Are we talking about the film Metamorphosis?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
the one that was filmed at Blue Morpho.
Yeah, Blue Morpho. I was just wondering about, like, I don't know. The guy kind of set me off. I don't know. It just seemed like it was kind of made for, you know, like what you're talking about, where people just go down to Amazon, they get their on personal healing, then they leave, kind of thing. And it wasn't really, like, to me, it didn't seem like they really touched, like, the, I don't know. I guess I don't know really what I'm asking, but
I think it's a good film in this sense. I think it is a very accurate depiction of what happens at Blue Morpho. I think it is a very accurate documentation of the experience of many gringos who go down to the Amazon to drink ayahuasca. And I think it is really good documentation of the ways in which Upper Amazonian shamanism has been adapted or has not been adapted to the needs of these foreigners who are coming down. So in that sense, I think it's an excellent film. We can get into a discussion about what these tourists are looking for and what they're getting.
It's just, really amazing.
That doesn't affect the film. I think the film is
definitely
a very good depiction of what these tourists are looking for and what they're getting.
It was just bizarre to me because, I mean, I've read people's accounts and stuff, and, I mean, I haven't seen too many ayahuasca sessions or anything like that, but, you know, even in my worst experiences, I've never reacted like those people were reacting. You know, like, I was just amazed that they had so much, like, you know, I don't know. It was just like they were tormented, it seemed, you know, like in their minds almost. I don't know. It's kind of weird.
I think that there's some group phenomena going on. I think that people when they drink ayahuasca, just as in most other areas of life, will often behave the way they think they're expected to behave. I think there is a strong strand in our popular psychology of a kind of abreactive Freudianism, which is that you heal by going through an emotional crisis. And I think that a lot of these things are carried into the ceremonies that are being depicted in that film. When I have sat with mestizos and indigenous people who have been drinking ayahuasca, there I never saw anything like that. And I think that's part of the changes that are being made by foreigners coming in and bringing their own kinds of psychological assumptions about what's supposed to happen when you are healing.
Yeah, that's actually what my girlfriend was thinking too, and me. We were like, well, maybe it's a group activity, like somebody starts reacting that way, and then they all think that.
Like I say, people behave the way they think they're supposed to behave, to a large extent. I think that people have experiences that they think they're supposed to have. Remember that if you pay thousands of dollars to go down to the Amazon and you experience what you think are discomforts in order to get there and stay there, you damn well better have an interesting experience.
But just not throwing up is not going to cut it.
Just throwing up is probably not going to cut it. You can do that at home. And I think, for example, there is, I have drunk ayahuasca that had toé in it. Like I said before, I never drank toé all by itself. And that certainly has an effect. And more, shamans who deal with gringos are putting toé into the ayahuasca. Because that's much more likely to produce some kind of an immediate experience than drinking ayahuasca. Drinking ayahuasca without toé can take some time before anything really happens.
I remember reading your book. It was like a month or something for somebody to.
It could be. Yeah, there was one. Person who became a great shaman. It took months before anything happened.
That'd be insane.
and that's why I will confess to you that one of my that at the beginning, as you learn, a lot of gringos have kind of cartoon figures. And one of the first things I ever saw with any great clarity was Bugs Bunny. because you start simple, and then you work up to stuff. But a lot of people, that isn't good enough for some, for people. They need more right away. And I think... it seems to me that there are people, I don't know how many, I don't know who they are. And again, I don't want to be, you know, I don't know what somebody's path is, but there are people who seem, you know how bird watchers have what they call a life list. What they do is they have this checklist of all the birds they want to see in their life.
Oh, okay.
And they have this checklist, and as they see, you know, a crested grackle, they can check that off their life list and say they have seen a crested grackle. There are mountain climbers who have a life list of peaks they want to reach. They have a life list of ascents they want to complete. And other mountain climbers have a great term for those kinds of mountain climbers. They're called peak baggers. They are interested primarily in checking things off their life list. They are interested primarily in putting peaks into the bags. And I think there are some people who are who have a life list of experiences, and they want to check them off. And on that list is, I want to experience ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And I think there's nothing wrong with experiencing ayahuasca. That's where you are. Who knows what the spirits are going to say to you when you drink ayahuasca? Who knows where that's going to lead you? We talked about this before. You don't know where somebody's going to go in the future, and it may be that somebody who goes down to check off ayahuasca after peyote or after DMT or before they check off iboga, it may be that they are on a spiritual path is leading them where the spirits want them to go.
Yeah.
And I'm in no position to comment about that. But I would suggest anybody who wants to drink ayahuasca under any set of circumstances, but especially down in the Amazon, why you really want to do that. What are you seeking? What's your goal? If you have a specific sickness you want healed, then acknowledge that to yourself. If you're on a spiritual quest of some kind, be explicit about that. If you're motivated by curiosity, then that's fine. I mean, that was my motivation. I was curious. That was my teacher's motivation when he was young and first started drinking ayahuasca. He was curious. And then he enjoyed seeing things, and so he became a shaman. But I think it's very important to be honest about exactly what it is that you want.
It almost reminds me of I don't know how to say this, of exercise, actually. I know that's kind of funny.
No, tell me about that. That's interesting.
Well, I started noticing, I mean, the first time I tried ayahuasca, It was interesting, but nothing really happened. It wasn't until the I don't know, 20th time or something that I started seeing stuff, and I started realizing there was a skill to it, or there was some kind of navigation, or maybe the spirits were. I totally related the last time we talked with you of sort of the thing of them standing on the other side and ready to hit you with a 2x4.
Yeah, definitely.
That's yeah. Definitely me. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. There was these crazy dragon looking things that scared the crap out of me, and they were snapping. Anyway, whatever. But it really did feel like exercise. Like there was a skill, there was a talent, there was something there, and you had to get better at it. And so then it seemed. It seemed more and more weird of just kind of like you're saying of people crossing off a bucket list of I've done ayahuasca. It almost seems like, oh yeah, I've lifted weights once or something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I agree with you completely, and I think that's a very good way of putting it. Are we still recording, by the way?
Or is it off? I've been saying some interesting things,
and I would hate. Have we lost all the interesting things we've been saying?
No, it's still on there. We can put this in there if you want. I mean,
there's a bunch of stuff that I think is interesting definitely. That we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm more of I don't know, I guess he is too. We're both in the scientist mode when we were starting. We're like, oh, what is this, you know?
How it's is just this related? DMT with an MAOI.
Yeah, how's this related to dreaming and stuff? And, since then, we've begun to realize that, you know, it shouldn't be looked at in a scientific manner, you know, specifically. It should be more, almost a spiritual kind of thing instead of... Because,
mm-hmm.
When I was asking you about, you were talking about the 2x4 thing. And I did it by myself once, and I got beat, you know, beat up pretty bad and scared the hell out of me. So I definitely respect it after that.
Yeah, what exactly did it say to you when you're after you thought you died and it was screaming at you and stuff?
It pretty much told me, you know, like, what am I doing there? And, you know, it asked me, it was like, who are you and what are you doing here? And I was like, I don't know, you know, like, I don't know what I'm doing here.
That's like, great, I like that.
It was scary. You know, it reminded me of being in the presence of God. That's what, I mean, I just read it last night, like, my account of it, and I was like, it was massive. It was only described as being in the presence of God. And it was like, you are nothing, you know, compared to me. Don't ever come back here. You know, don't ever challenge me again. I was like, okay, you know. Never said don't come back, but it just said, you know, like, in a way, have respect, you know, like, respect what you're doing and don't treat it like, you know, walking down the road or something like that, you know.
That sounds like real good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely switched very quickly from this is an interesting thing I'm going to tinker with to, like, oh my God, there's a whole universe I didn't understand and I'm mucking around with things I don't understand. And yeah, I don't know.
That sounds like a really good experience.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it took me a long time to actually get over it. So, but it scared me because after that, I started having anxiety attacks, and then I was wondering if maybe, you know, like, in some way I had like an attack, you know, like a dart stuck in me or something like that. Because it felt like it, even though I hadn't read about darts or anything. I seriously felt like there was something stuck in me and I couldn't get it out. And yeah.
Yeah, didn't you feel like you said there's something?
I read about everybody's like got all brujeria on their mind, and everybody is especially in Iquitos. Iquitos is a city of gossip. Iquitos is a city of paranoia. I think that people are overly concerned about sorcery.
Really?
I'm not going to say it doesn't happen, but somebody once asked me how I protect myself against sorcery. And I said that I think my best protection against sorcery is my insignificance.
That's awesome.
I mean, why would anybody bother with me? And I think that perhaps if people had a keener sense of their own insignificance, they wouldn't be so worried about sorcery.
I agree.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I wasn't really interested, you know, worried about sorcery or anything. I didn't even know it existed, really, besides, like, in a religious context. So,
no, I wasn't talking about your experience in particular.
I certainly
would do nothing to minimize the impact of that experience on you. I what I'm saying is that you go online to discussion groups and there is just so much discussion about sorcery. There is a kind of paranoid atmosphere in Iquitos.
Really?
And although there is a certain paranoid style in mestizo shamanism, it seems to have become acute in Iquitos, and I think in part because of the rapid cultural change which is being caused by the influx of all of these foreign tourists. And foreign tourists tend to be insular. There is an expatriate community in Iquitos, which tends to be insular and sometimes kind of paranoid. And I think that atmosphere is very much a part of Iquitos, unfortunately. I think that people should be less concerned with that than they often are. I mean, who cares about me? Why would a sorcerer go out of his way to do anything to me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And burn stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know. I don't claim to be a shaman. I make no claims for myself. I'm not in competition with anybody. Add to that that I have been given the protection of my teacher. I have been given the phlegm of my teacher, which protects me. And to the extent that anybody cares, I am a student of my teacher. And to do anything bad to me would be considered an offense to my teacher. But I don't think any of that is important. I think what matters is I'm not important enough for anybody to go to any trouble.
And maybe that's what it is it's, you know, they're bringing into that sense of, you know, the me thing, I am important kind of thing into the whole thing, and thinking that, you know, the paranoia kind of increases because of that. They're like, everybody's after me because right. I'm so important kind of thing. So, I definitely,
Again, it's like people who come back after a couple of weeks and say, oh, now I'm a shaman.
Yeah.
Sounds like to me shaman is a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like a journey rather than a title, you know. So
I think that's right. And I think people who go down there should be very cautious when they deal with programs and say, we will give you, you know, a certification.
Wow. I didn't even know that existed, to be honest with you.
So I always come back to the same thing, which is that what gets in the way is always ego. And that if ayahuasca teaches anything, it's that ego is what gets in the way of right relationship with the plants and with the spirits and with other people. And it is the relationship of confianza, of mutuality, of generosity, of trust with human persons and with other than human persons, which is ultimately the most important thing.
I noticed that you, in your bio, you said that you were in Tibet for, I don't know how long it was, but like a couple of years or something, right? Is that right?
I wasn't in Tibet. At the time, I was living in the Tibetan monastery.
Oh, okay.
Because the Chinese were still in the process of conquering Tibet, and there was a shooting war going on between India and China that nobody knows about. So what I did was stay with a Tibetan refugee community up in the part of India that's called Himachal Pradesh. If you picture a map of India, there's sort of a horn that goes up on each side, and in between those horns is Nepal. Okay. And then on the left side horn, there is a section of India that sort of goes up between Nepal on the east and Kashmir on the west. And it was up in that area in the mountains that I stayed with a Tibetan refugee community for a year and a half.
That's awesome.
There.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
Yeah. Well, it was neat. It sounds like what you've learned, you know, through the Buddhist teachings and stuff like that has really helped out with your book and interviews, like the middle of the road.
It's interesting how life goes in circles, and you come back to places you were a long time ago, and but they're different. The second time you're there.
Yeah, well, you know, actually, and before we let you go, but I mean, what are you going to do next? Do you have any projects you're working on, or is there any what's in the future for you?
Don't know. I have become very interested in San Pedro shamanism. So I've become interested. There are some excellent books out there, that some of which have gone out of print, unfortunately, on San Pedro shamanism. I don't know. I will see what doors the spirits open for me, and hopefully they will not be there with a 2x4.
Oh, the 2x4. Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, let's
thanks
you go
so
here.
Much.
Thank you so yeah. much.
All right. Well, thank you both so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Cosmic Echo. And again, if you enjoyed this episode and would like to continue to support us, we ask that you visit our website at www.taileaters.com/CE podcast, where you can donate on our Patreon page. We look forward to providing you an additional podcast in the near future and can't wait to share that with you. Thanks and happy dreaming.